This is Kate Magruder. It's August 10th, 2018. I'm recording an oral history for Promise of Paradise, Oral Histories of Back to the Land Movement in Mendocino County. Would you introduce yourself?
I'm Karen Rizzolo.
And when and where were you born?
I was born in 1954 in Hackensack, New Jersey.
And can you describe to me how you grew up? What shaped you as you were growing up?
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And during my childhood, my parents bought some property on Mount Hamilton out of San Jose. And on that ranch, we had horses and cows and chickens. And we would go up there many weekends. And so that was my big introduction to the love of the rural life.
And when and why did you come to Mendocino County? How did that happen?
I came to Mendocino County in 1975 after looking for places to buy with various friends in the early 70s and came across an article in Mother Earth News about a group of people on Mid Mountain Ranch that were saying there's property for sale, and if you'd like to come stay with us and check it out, come on out. And that's how we came to Potter Valley.
Had you ever been up to Mendocino County before?
I came to Mendocino County one other time that I recall. We were traveling through Ukiah to Oregon in our old beat-up truck, and our truck broke down in Ukiah, and I thought, why would anyone ever want to live in Ukiah where it's 110 degrees in the summer? That was my first experience of Mendocino County.
And when you came to Mid Mountain Ranch in Potter Valley, what were your first impressions? What were you going to do here?
So when we first came to Mendocino County, to Mid Mountain, and take advantage of this offer to camp on land and look at the parcel next door to these people, we were young. I was 21, and we figured, well, we could make a living somehow. My partner at the time had done some carpentry work. We had been living on a goat dairy, and we were full of enthusiasm and the can-do attitude, so we weren't really planning very much.
And did you indeed buy that parcel on Mid Mountain?
So we didn't end up buying the property on Mid Mountain because it seemed too remote, and we didn't feel like we could earn a living if we lived that far out because it was up miles of dirt road. So when we were searching for a place to live, we said Potter Valley. We were looking for a place in Potter Valley and decided to just move here and rent until we could find a place to buy. As we were looking for a place to rent, the realtor said, oh, by the way, this parcel just came up for sale. It's 10 acres, lower pine, and it was $15,000. And we felt that we could swing that, and our initial mortgage payments were $86 a month.
How did you first settle in? What was the process of making yourself a home here?
Well, our property was bare land when we first moved here, and we had collected a bunch of materials and just built a shack with no windows and cut the windows out as we got the windows and got jobs. I got a job at the county hospital through a funded program, and we did salvage work. My partner salvaged chicken coops from Petaluma and collected materials so that we could build a house and get settled. We had to develop water when we first moved here. We live on a creek. We had to develop a system for having running potable water. So initially we had a water tank that we hoisted into a big oak tree, and we would get water from acquaintances that lived in the valley and pump water up to that tank in the tree and piped it down to the house. But we were some of the first people in the Back to the Land community with actually running water in our dwelling. Though everyone was very impressed.
What do you remember about those early years? What was especially difficult and what was especially wonderful?
Well, when we first built our first cabin, We built it in kind of the hottest spot on the property. And boy, it's funny how you erase the most difficult things. We were very idealistic, and we would made do. We had a wringer washer for washing the clothes, and we'd go to town once a week and get groceries, and it was a good times as far as I remember. Eventually there was community, so we would play volleyball on Sundays at different people's places and have potlucks, and we were living the dream. And we were young and strong, so we could do it. And the community of newcomers came together to help. So when someone had a project, everybody came and made it happen.
And what was your impression of Ukiah at that time when you'd actually moved here and you were beginning to foray into town to do things? What was your sense of Ukiah, and how did the community of Ukiah respond to you?
So Ukiah was definitely the center, although we usually, except for if we were working, we didn't go into Ukiah very often. So we weren't really as involved in the Ukiah community and the growth of the Ukiah community until maybe the early 80s, when things like the Farmers Market or the Ukiah Birth Collective were really blossoming. And then it was a hub, but our main hub was here in the valley. We didn't really want to drive into town if we didn't have to.
Do you remember events at the Grange in Potter Valley?
I do remember the breakfasts at the Grange. And I vaguely remember maybe a few dances or things. Mostly our social events were right here in the sort of mid-mountain or in the valley region with more of the back to the landers. And it wasn't until later, when a bunch of us got together to open the clinic, that we became more immersed in the valley life and integrating with the old timers.
What would you do at night when you first moved here and you had a cabin that didn't have any windows? And what were you eating? And what were you doing to just kind of lift your spirits?
When we were living without electricity, well, we're still off the grid, but when we had kerosene lamps for lighting and our old propane refrigerator for refrigeration, we'd play cards. We played a lot of cards and read books. We did a lot of reading, played some music, told stories. That's what we did. And then eventually, of course, we had our first child in 1978 and our second child in 1980. So the kids took up a lot of time. So we went to bed early. So as far as the birth of our children goes, my daughter was a breech birth. We did have her at home in Windsor. At the time, in 1978, all of the other midwives in the birth collective were also pregnant. So there was sort of a dearth of midwives available. And then in 1980, when we had my son, he was born at home. And it was a wonderful thing.
How did the Potter Valley Health Collective, how did that come into being?
In the early days, the health clinic, the Potter Valley Health Clinic, from my recollection, what came out of a dream of several people, Marge Garrick and Ross and Lynn Ritter. And I think part of it came because of the home birth movement and then also the need for health care in the community. So in the 70s, in the 76, the Birth Collective was active. And at that time, there was an organization called the Rural Institute, which was a nonprofit. And in 76, my mother passed away, and a percentage of her estate went to nonprofits. And I was able to direct a few thousand dollars, it wasn't much, to the Rural Institute to be funneled to the Birth Collective, which allowed them to buy some equipment. And then Ross Ritter was part of that as a midwife and eventually went on to get his physician's assistant's license. So he and Jim Katzel helped provide the medical care for that to happen. And before I had children, I was working at the community hospital, so I had some knowledge of billing and medical records. So using all the resources and everyone's knowledge and passion, we were able to open it and work for nothing for a few years until we got state funding, and that's how it happened. For me, the success of the Potter Valley Health Center was that the health center served the whole community, and it was close to the school. We had some projects with the school doing physical activities. We were able to provide condoms to the teenagers, and we were able to do blood pressure checks for the old folks. And in those intimate settings of caring for the community, we heard lots of stories and really developed a love for everyone in the community that was priceless.
As you look back on that time, how would you describe the way that being here shaped you?
Being part of the Back to the Land movement and living here and staying here, it's just made me appreciate life and the energy of nature and living in nature, and feel very privileged to live in this unique spot with Mother Nature. And I feel like I've helped to nurture the land, and the land has nurtured me and made me a better person, taught me how to be kind, how to be observant. The land nurtures me. What was I thinking? I think I didn't really know. I didn't really have a direction. I left home when I was 16. So I was really sort of bumbling along, and there must have been some attraction to the land that I didn't think of intentionally, but it fit. And so when the puzzle pieces fit together, it was home. Back in the 70s, we were reading Mother Earth News, lots of Wendell Berry essays and other authors and periodicals that espoused Back to the Land. And we had been living on this goat dairy, so we were already making cheese. We had 25 hives of bees when we came to Potter Valley, so we were selling honey. We wanted to make the farmer's market go. It was just in me.
Can you describe the early years of the farmer's market? How did that develop?
The farmer's market was just this incredible experience. A group of us that somehow got connected with the farm advisor's office and Rod Shippey, who I will always admire for what he did for the community. And he brought this diverse group of people together to fulfill a dream, to sell our produce and to come up with some rules about how to do it. I don't know that we ever really made that much money, but we sold our carrots and our honey and made friends with some remarkable people who were incredible farmers and shared with the Ukiah community, who wasn't as agricultural. So it was a good way to just connect with the community and also to iron out some of the political business things that needed to happen to actually make a farmer's market come into being.
What were some of the challenges of actually carrying off a farmer's market, making it successful?
One was just all these strong-willed, independent-minded people that thought they had all the answers, and then complying with the rules. So there was debate about whether people could import produce from the valley to sell at the farmer's market, and trying to develop our skills so that we had enough produce for year-round or however many months to make a viable market, how to advertise, how to comply with all the agricultural and consumer rules. And everyone had an opinion. It was a very opinionated, a vocal group of people. And Rod seemed to be able to direct us to a compromise and pull it off.
Who were some of those main players?
The main players that I remember were Mike Shapiro, Marilyn and Troll Brandon, Christopher Rowe and Will McKinney, Cindy and David Rink from McNabb. Marge and Clarence Garrick brought in watermelons from Potter Valley, and they were sort of the old timers. And there was probably somebody with peaches. I'm not exactly sure who. It brought together people from at least most of the inland community. Actually, Paul Katzoff from Thanksgiving Coffee was also involved. There was a crew.
Where was the first site?
The first site of the farmer's market was off of State Street, where there's an apartment complex there now. I don't remember the name. I could show you if we drove down State Street. There's a bridge. It was probably like along Gibson Creek there. So that was where it first was. It was beautiful because it wasn't developed and there were a bunch of oak trees.
Was it by where the community center was on State Street, the little house?
The other side. It was on the east side of the street.
The community center for a few years was right there where Mike Shapiro then had his office. His real estate office moved into that building.
I have actually a picture of Christopher selling flowers there. Yeah.
I have a memory of you dancing. My memory of you in a certain period of your life as you were growing up here, as we were going through time here, was of you would make a point of always finding the most wonderful place to dance.
Dancing, yes, has been an integral part of my spiritual journey. So we used to dance. We'd have little parties with bands and dance. And then in the much later years, there was the Hedonists for Liberty and Justice with Phil Baldwin and Roy Tyndall. And we would bring bands to the community and just have a good time at the old Ukiah Grange. And that was such a lovely spot. It was really sad to see that grange go. And we also, we had some at the Redwood Valley Grange too. That was a good time when we could stay up late. And yeah, those were the days.
As you look back, is there an experience or a moment, a memory that kind of epitomizes for you what those, especially those early years, were like, a flash that lives in you?
Well, there's lots of flashes that live in me that have sort of epitomized the experience of coming back to the land. I think at one point, probably about 20 years ago, so I've been here over 40 years, about 20 years, 25 years ago, when I was deciding whether to stay on this piece of property or not, it was the day after Thanksgiving, and I took a little hike just up on the one of the knolls on our property, and I looked down, and I could hear the kids playing, and I realized that this was home, and this is where I needed to be, and it's just stuck, and I've been able to eke it out and feel blessed.
How have you been able to eke it out? How has your ability to make a life for yourself, make a living for yourself, how has that unfolded?
So to make a living and eke it out here, we had to do a bunch of different things. We had sold produce at the farmer's market. My husband helped salvage some of the materials from the old farms. Most of our houses from salvaged material, old chicken coops in Petaluma and the floors from the Press Democrat building in Santa Rosa. So we didn't need a lot of money back in those days to survive. And I haven't paid a PG&E bill in 43 years. So we got by with less. That was one way to succeed, and we still continue to grow a lot of our own food. And my job at the community hospital through the CEMER program, which was, I was 21, so I still hit the age limit for low-income youth. It was a training program, so the county would pay half of the wages, and then it was a split, so they were encouraged to employ youth and train youth. And I started working at the switchboard and then went to medical records and then went to billing. And so those experiences stuck with me, and I was able to incorporate them when we opened the health center in Potter Valley. And I worked there for quite a while and learned some bookkeeping and accounting, and then went into more social service skills, and it sustained me during a lot of the time, the primary steady breadwinner. And then my partner would do different carpentry jobs here and there, and ended up working over on the Eel River, measuring the water flow and the fish vitality. So yeah, we just did what we could, and it didn't cost a lot to live. Not like young people now, where need a lot more money.
I'm going to cycle back. Can you describe to me what the Birth Collective was like? What was that? What was going on there? And was it legal to be being a midwife at that time?
So the Birth Collective, when I first was introduced to it, was there was an apartment on Smith Street called the Uptown Apartments, or that was the nickname of it. And I think also some of the Class K United Stand folks had a room there or something. And there were a group of lay midwives, Diane Pageant and Lynn Meadows, that were doing home births. And it was not legal. They didn't have any licenses. And there was some mistrust of the hospital and traditional medicine and the format of birthing at that time. But it was pretty well organized. You had a medical chart. You went in for regular screenings, and people were screened out if they were high risk, or that was the intent. And I don't remember that there was a fee. I think people bartered, or there was some agreed upon fee. I wasn't able to have my first child through the Birth Collective, partly because she was breech and because of the pregnancy of the other midwives, but we were able to find a doctor in Sonoma County that would deliver her, and we paid him a bucket of honey. So there was just a lot of support, and there were prenatal classes, and it was something people had a passion about, so they just did it. And there was a lot of reference to the book Spiritual Midwifery, so that was kind of a Bible that people went by as far as how to have a birth. And we were young and idealistic and invincible.
Can you describe the Uptown Apartments, what it was like when you would walk up the stairs to the Uptown Apartments and what you would find up there?
So the Uptown Apartments, so it's on Smith Street in Ukiah. And it was kind of a little bit dingy. And then there were a couple of rooms. And it was comfortable. It wasn't clinical. I think there were maybe a couple of couches. And I don't remember having specific appointment times, although I'm thinking that they must have had certain hours or some plan that you were going to show up at a certain time to get checked out. We must have had some prenatal yoga classes there too. It was just a supportive place to be if you were pregnant. And I remember when I intentionally got pregnant, which when we told a neighbor that I was pregnant, he was shocked to find out that we actually wanted to be pregnant and had planned it. And I was still relatively young. I was 23, but that was just part of the plan.
Was this a neighbor who was from this area, who wasn't familiar with that kind of forethought?
Yeah, so we were on our way to play volleyball on Mid-Mountain at Apache Flats. And we were riding in the back of somebody's pickup truck, a bunch of us, as the sort of caravan to go play volleyball went. And I had pretty bad morning sickness during my pregnancy. And my husband had said to him, "Oh, yeah, well, you know, Karen's pregnant." And he was just shocked at the idea that you would want to do that. But then, of course, he ended up with a couple kids a few years later, too. So it was just part of what was happening to us as we were maturing, maybe.
Was there a time when you were very afraid of something that was happening around you here?
You know, I'm sure there were times where things may have been going on where I was frightened, although I think I've probably blocked most of those out. I have very idealistic memories of what we went through and what we were going through and living the dream. I've always felt pretty safe here. You know, whether that's naive, I don't know, but we've had a few conflicts with some neighbors over the years. We've managed to work things out.
Do you have to make agreements with neighbors about keeping up roads, just infrastructure around you?
We have a road association for one road, but people have access, you know, easements through our property, which we have discouraged them from using. And there have been some conflicts when people have been disrespectful of the space and the road, but we intentionally built the house a little bit away from the road on our property so that we wouldn't have to deal with it. And there've been times, maybe 25 years ago, when there were yahoos driving through or hunters. I'm sure there were times when people were driving through, or we heard stories about people up the road that were hassled, that maybe I did feel unsafe, but I guess you just kind of go with it, and it's part of living in the country.
Were you part of Class K? When you came here, did you have to deal with the house building codes?
So when we first came here, one of the attractions actually to Mendocino County was the whole Class K movement. When we started looking in Mendocino County, part of it was because we had heard about the Class K movement. And actually, we had written a letter to Class K, or to Sol and Anon, saying, hey, is there anything in your neighborhood for sale? Because we figured that if there was a movement like that happening, that was a place we wanted to be, where people were trying to do their own thing and be creative. Now, in hindsight, as I've grown, and maybe I'm a little bit wiser, I can see the logic behind having some of those building codes and rules, and the intent of those codes is to protect people. But when you're 21 and you know everything, and you want to build your house the way you want to build it, even if it turns out maybe you should have put closets in, yeah, you don't believe it then. You think you know everything. And so we were of that mindset when we moved here. And, you know, some of those decisions I regret, but oh well. If you'll notice, our windows are all old dairy case windows. So they're all double pane windows and salvaged windows. And I think all the windows in the house cost us $200. So, you know, it worked. That ingenuity and salvaging worked for us.
Did cannabis and those years of camp and the scariness of that, did that play a part in your life?
So there was a time when there would be helicopters flying and people would be afraid that they would get busted, and there were some busts, and it was a bit unnerving to know that. And there was also the greedy aspect of it that was frustrating, because people wanted to grow a few plants, great, and make a little money, but there were people that eventually got greedy and brought attention to the community, and that was, I think, part of the downfall of the community and why people ended up leaving or having to leave.
Do you remember when Sensimilla, when a new way of cultivating marijuana was introduced to us here?
Yes, I remember the early days of marijuana, because people would have a garden and people would be harvesting leaves, and that was great. We would have people come up from the city and they'd be pulling off leaves of the few plants we had. And I think it was a word of mouth about how to, oh, well, if you do this, then you're going to get better pot and you should try it. So there was definitely that interest in how to do it better. And I think that the whole influence of marijuana on the Back to the Land movement changed the community. So people that started growing a lot and making a lot of money changed a little bit. There was more drugs, there was some cocaine happening, and people moved away and the values changed and people left. And there were other people that were successful growers and started other small businesses and sort of helped develop some of the organizations in the community too. So it wasn't all bad.
So that segues right into the, how do you think the phenomenon of the Back to the Land movement in this county, how has that shaped the county? When you think about what this place was like when you first came in the mid-70s, how has it changed over the last 40 so years? And the fact that all those people came and did what they did, how did that affect that change, do you think?
The change that was brought about by the Back to the Land movement to our community, it's pretty complex. I think Mendocino County has attracted a lot of really bright, creative people. And I think it's developed sort of in bits and pieces, where our agriculture has gotten better. We have things like the Grain Project or a much more sophisticated farmers market or even the community gardens that have developed over the last 10 or 15 years have all been influenced by the knowledge of the old timers that were here when we first came and the enthusiasm of the newcomers and the sort of belief that we could make a change or that we could do something different. Sort of the marriage of that old time knowledge and the interest of those newcomers to cultivate that knowledge and use it to make a better, more vibrant community and hopefully maybe even inspire a better world in the time that we're in, how to take care of ourselves and how to take care of those that need a little help.
What's been left undone? If you were looking and thinking, oh, I have this much chunk of time left to be here, it's almost like waking a sleeping giant of all of the people like you who came and had the opportunity that you had to be here and be productive and be creative. Is there something that we're missing that we're not attending to now?
What needs to be done, what still's left to be done is kind of a small piece of our greater society that needs to be done. Just how do we approach every day with kindness and appreciation of what we have is how I see it. So if I have excess produce, who do I share it with and how do I share it? Or I bring flowers into the clinic because it brings me joy and I see what it does to other people. And sharing the nurturing of the earth, because really that's the place we all share. And so living in this back to the land movement, being part of it and experiencing it for me is continuing to do it and continuing to offer opportunities to young people to also explore that and to support them in doing it. And support that might be, oh, volunteering in the school or having a relationship with a young child or helping an elder communicate with their family across the country. It doesn't really, there's so many ways that we can give to the community and just person to person. That's been my political activism and how I've tried to live in a back to the land kind of way.
Have you had an occasion or opportunity to notice the relationship, if there is one even, between the Latino community and the back to the landers, the people who came here with those values? How do they engage with each other?
I think how the back to the land community engages with the Latino community is pretty varied. It depends. So those that have traveled to Spanish-speaking countries and communities and speak Spanish might be able to engage more, but it's sort of the having the awareness. So one of my pet peeves is that our farmers market is downtown, where generally speaking, the more affluent part of the community and maybe the more Caucasian part of the community congregates. So there's options for fresh local food to that community. And how can we move it to the south end of town where more of the Latino community lives and build those relationships? And working at the clinic, I see that we serve a lot of that population. And so part of what I'm continually trying to be aware of is how do we serve the Latino community? Or maybe it's more like how do we blend with the community and appreciate the uniqueness?
Is there a song that you connect with those early years of being here?
Actually, singing has not been part of my expression. Dancing has been. But, you know, there's that old Doobie Brothers song, Ukiah. You don't know that song? Oh, if I had a good voice, I would sing it to you. Anyway, I mean, that's not necessarily a song that I would sing to myself, but it's kind of funny that there was a song. There is a song. You'll have to, you know, Google it.
Do you remember the words? Any of the words?
No, I don't. Not off the top of my head. But I'll Google it. Yeah, you should. You should.
Is there anything else that you particularly want to make sure you get to say about what this experience has been for you?
The thing I'd like to bring up about the Back to the Land movement is that I think it's really important that we be thoughtful in how we grow. And I'm really glad that not everyone is comfortable living in this kind of environment. And I think it's really important that we be very thoughtful about growth and our water resources. When we moved here, it was a time when the general plan was initially happening, or a one version of the general plan. And we were able to buy 10 acres, but all the parcels around us, except for the other three tens, it was a 40 acre minimum. And I'm so glad. I'm glad I was able to afford the 10 acres, but I'm really glad that those 40 acre restrictions were in place, because there's so much wildlife and there's not enough water to support a large community. So I think having areas of population density for those people who it's easier or more comfortable to live in a densely populated area with all the resources and advantages, it's important to have that. And we need to preserve open space however we can, and be conscious of it.